Okay, hello everyone. You're listening to Back in the USSR here on 93.3 FM CFRU. We are speaking to Dr. Michael Parenti, progressive author and scholar based in Berkeley, California. And we're going to talk to him about his recent book, which I believe just came out in April of this year. It's called Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies. And you can read more of Michael's stuff at michaelparenti.org. And I'll mention that again later on. So hello, Michael. How's it going?
Hello, how are you, Siegfried?
Pretty good. It's been a while since we last talked, so I'm glad we got this opportunity to do so, especially in light of, well, I mean, just everything that's been going on in the world now and, like, the appropriate timing, I think, of this this book you've just put out. So,
thank you.
Yeah, if we maybe could just kind of launch right into things. My first question is basically if you could just outline what is austerity?
Well, austerity is the imposition, the imposing upon the working people scarcity and hardship. And that's done by those at the top who work us and work us,
mm-hmm.
and who have all sorts of political rallies where they talk about the loafers and the lazy people and who don't want to work and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they blame, and the poor are always blamed for their own poverty. They are seen as the authors of their own poverty when in fact that's not true. And the truth is that wealth creates poverty. In many instances, poverty is the creation of by wealth. I mean, slaves wasn't their laziness. They put in 18-hour days of toil of all kinds, and the plantation owners' wealth and luxury and accumulation was from the exploitation of the poor. So that's how you get wealth. A few people will expropriate the land and labor and resources of everybody else. That's one of the points one has to make. Well, mm-hmm. what was it you were asking again?
Well, this is what is austerity, basically, right? Like, of course, we're hearing this term like all the time these days, like about austerity, the need for austerity. It's like the language, the chosen language, you could say, of the elite, which is kind of imposing this. And you see in Europe, we see in North America, we see like really all over the world now since the recession.
They don't want to say homelessness and hunger and no access to medical care.
Right.
You know, they call it austerity. You know, like learn to curb and don't be a freeloader and all that. When in fact, it's the rich. It's that 1% or one fraction of 1% at the top that is really the freeloader. Nobody goes to the government for more handouts than the very, very super rich. They they have enormous amounts of policies and programs for their own benefit. If I don't lose my voice here, I think you got my point.
Oh, absolutely. Well, I mean, and it almost seems like austerity is almost like a feature of the capitalist system in general. It's just the word maybe has kind of come into vogue, but I mean, they've been doing this for a long time, right?
Yeah, they most certainly have been doing it for a long time. Yes, that's correct. Yes. And whenever there was a set of circumstances at World War II that changed things around a bit. We came out of a deep depression
mm-hmm.
that had lasted about 15 years. I mean, the New Deal did a lot of good things, but, you know, it never really got the U.S. out of its depression. And then came the war.
Mm-hmm.
The war was actually a lot of good-paying jobs for people. The ruling class spent amounts of money to kill people and destroy towns and cities, an amount that it would not spend in peacetime to get people out of the depression. But that war got people out of the depression. 9 million American men, mostly men, almost all men, came back from the war, and there was a GI Bill that was passed for them. And that was a remarkable thing, because unlike the GI Bill today, where where veterans have to also get a a job on the side and, mm-hmm. or take out student loans or whatever else, the GI Bill does not help them the way it promised to really do. But in those days, it did, and it also gave money for small businesses to start and all that. So there was a tremendous burst of prosperity, of spending. there was a pileup of money that people had from 4 years of working in the defense plants where they couldn't spend that money because all those factories were not making refrigerators and stoves and cars. They were making bombs and planes and tanks and things of that sort. So this combination of things, plus there was not a stripping down. There was a big stripping down of the military, of course, but a substantial military was kept going 1946-47 because of the Cold War was starting. The Red Army was on the Elbe. The big communist parties in France and Italy. The workers in Western Europe were developing social democracies. They were getting free medical care. They were getting job programs, free education, these things. That they were doing that because people in Eastern Europe were getting the same kinds of things, and it was a sort of a historic compromise. Which we had to, keep up with the Reds. Here in the communist countries, people spent only one tenth of their salary for rent. They had free medical care. They had free education up to the highest level of their abilities. They had very subsidized and improved transportation, and all these kind of things were happening. So the West had to do some of the same things, and it was what were being built then in those days was you had a well-being that had never existed quite like that before in the West, and that's when the mythology also emerged that America is the land of prosperity, and for whatever prosperity, they really advertised it and ideologized it, if I can create a word. It was part of the ideology that only in America we have everybody's got a car now, and the whole transportation infrastructure was built with government money, people's public money, to subsidize the automotive industry, and these super highways were built and all of that at public expense for the trucking industry and the automotive industry's benefit. And this went on, and then when you got to the late 70s, early 80s, they started turning it all around. Reagan came in, and there was the feeling was, enough is enough, we've got to roll this back. And they've done a terrific job of doing just that thing. And so you now have that great, prosperous middle class that we always heard about and all that, now much pitied and much rolled back and going broke in many instances.
Yeah, so of course we see this kind of momentary historical compromise that now is being clawed back, and I guess austerity is the latest incarnation, at least of the language of that rollback.
Right, austerity and impoverishment and oppression, those were the normal conditions of capitalism in the United States all through the 1800s and the early 1900s, and right up until the late part of the 20th century. 80s or so is a turnaround, and you get more and more of it today. Today, mm-hmm. you have students graduating college with $75,000 debts. You have the same rollback going on, of course, now in Eastern Europe.
Mm-hmm, that's true.
They don't owe the working class anything anymore. They just started rolling them back, Richard Pipes, of all people, I mean, a conservative like him, I'll give him credit. He didn't suppress the study, but he did the study of all the former communist countries, how things are, And it came out overwhelmingly, people saying it was better under communism.
Mm-hmm.
Better under communism, you know. The farmers would say it was better. We got subsidies. We could sell our stuff and this and that and students. It was better for them. It was better for public transportation. Was better. The healthcare system was more equitable, more accessible, and you can go on. So that's what they're really. The whole game is really a class. Class struggle game, that's what it is.
Yeah. If I could go back to something you mentioned very briefly before, was just how war is now being like tied in with austerity. You see, like, you know, with austerity now, you see increased rise of interventions of like basically the American military and Western military forces abroad, and increased violence around the world. And increased interventions and these kind of things. So how does that really, imperialism, tie in with austerity?
Well, imperialism, the empire feeds off the republic. I mean, where does an empire get its operational wealth from? From the republic, from the
mm-hmm.
people. You got to tax the American public. How do you get to tax them? And so that you have a federal budget every year in which 52% is for military purposes right there. That's just 52% off the top. And not to mention a lot of other things, military pensions, all sorts of other stuff. But so the way you do that is you convince your public that this is for their safety. We have to control the world or the world will devour us. And so we've been seeing it again and again and again. Imperialism is an extension, an outgrowth of capitalism, but it's also a way of you know, making the world safe for the plutocracy. That's really its great goal. And to provide places for investment and further profit at greater margins than before.
Yeah, and I guess this kind of goes into the whole profit pathology, right? Because, I mean, I think you even said in one of your talks, you know, the whole idea that capitalism can never stay home. Like, it has to keep expanding. And
yes.
If it doesn't expand, I mean, basically it collapses, right? So, I mean, like, imperialism and capitalism, I guess, go hand in hand with regard to that.
It's a mad system. That's mm-hmm. why I said pathology. I mean, yeah, it is a mad system. It's designed to pay workers as little as possible and yet hope that there'll be many workers with lots of spending power to pick up all these commodities and services that I'm creating with these underpaid workers, you know. And my hope is that some other owner will give their workers enough money so they'll have the money to buy up the goods and services that my underpaid workers are creating. But the other owners have the same idea, and they too underpay their workers. And so there's a chronic overproduction. There's a chronic underconsumption. Even though we have a big consumer society, there's all sorts of crap that you got more things, you know, consumer items and gizmos and even in the area of food, where the food is, I mean, the fast food stuff is uneatable, but there it is, expensive and cheap in some cases. But so imperialism is the outgrowth of capitalism. War brings a false prosperity, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And socialism, what imperialism is socialism coming to the rescue again. Capitalism is always rescued by the government. I mean, the number of programs of research and development in all sorts of areas, the railroad industry, the mining industry, the steel industry, the airline industry, the internet industry, all these things are publicly owned. That plutocratic class that constantly denounces the government, constantly scolds the American people, as you're saying, austerity, stop looking for a handout from the government, stop running off to the government with silly, wasteful things like Social Security and Medicare.
Mm-hmm.
And all. If I didn't have those, I'd be out on the street right now myself. I'm telling. No, it's not funny.
So, well, I mean, there's a lot of people, right? Like, who face that.
Yeah, yeah. And as I said before, the irony is, of course, that same plutocracy goes to the government, I mean, owns the government, I mean, gets more subsidies,
mm-hmm.
agribusiness, trillions of dollars in subsidies, pharmaceuticals, trillions, the medicine industry, and now with Obamacare, you've got the health insurance industry
mm-hmm.
piping up their racket. It's gotten more, it's given people more services, but it has been but these guys get their shakedown before we ever see any services.
Yeah, and I guess this is the real face of the capitalist state, right? The state serving the capitalist class, like these, the Fortune 500. I guess you could say serving their interests and not the interests of the people.
That's correct. Yeah. It ends up serving their interests. They'll take any good program or need that's needed. They'll argue against it. They'll denounce it. But then they'll put through a version of it where they end up walking away with enormous profits.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you have to engage in a big ideological struggle against the capitalists or imperialists, at least with people when trying to convince them. What I did in this book, Profit Pathology, is I suggested a very simple empirical approach to, rather than an ideological struggle of grand isms, my superism against your superism or whatever, and just do empirical choices. Just look at things. I say, let's have socialism wherever socialism works better than capitalism. Well, we've been taught that socialism's a flop and it doesn't work, and that's that. But, you know, public utilities work much better than private utilities. The rates are cheaper, the service is better. You don't have CEOs who are making $2, $3, $4 million a year as CEO of the utility. You don't have all the kickbacks and whatever else.
Mm-hmm.
We have a private utility here in California, PG&E, which brought death to users in San Bruno, where people in San Bruno were smelling gas and complaining and saying there's a gas leak somewhere here, and the company didn't. The company is too busy scooping up profits for itself, and it blew up, and 8 people were killed, and another 35 were seriously hurt, and about 40 or 50 houses. If you had seen the photos, I don't know if you ever got them there. They were staggering. These houses were just blown right off their foundations, just nothing there, torn apart like a tornado or something. So public utilities are better. The rates are lower. Your surplus doesn't go to stockholders to enrich them. Your surplus goes into the public budget, and that helps the taxpayers a little, you know. Let's look at schools. Public schools, public universities are better than private ones. The idea that we now have more and more private for-profit universities, for-profit. The school admits that it creates this university to make profits for its shareholders, not for education. Well, again, it would be a lot cheaper if you just have a public university, that you don't have to be producing large amounts of wealth for the shareholders. All the money goes back into the school. How about public medicine, public health care, public hospitals?
Mm-hmm.
They're better. And the things that public transportation is so much more efficient, so much better for the environment and the like. Public transportation here carts more people than that congestion and slaughter of cars does. So what do we do for capitalism? Maybe restaurants. Maybe restaurants. We can say it's better that the restaurant is owned by mom and pop, and they really have the little touch to it, than having the state. Judging from my experience with restaurants in socialist countries, I might lean in that direction. So What I'm saying is, instead of getting into an isms fight, let's just go social function by social function and say, well, what's been better? What's been better? Tell us, really.
Yeah, like just kind of bring it down to like that empirical level, right? I mean, I have a similar story, actually. I mean, you were telling the story about what happened in California where, like, you know, those houses were blown away.
Yeah.
Once again, there's a result of that private company, and the cutbacks and all this kind of stuff. A similar thing happened in Ontario in the 1990s. In this case, it had to do with the privatization of water systems. And,
yeah.
This is something that definitely should be in the public domain, needless
yeah.
to say.
Now, if there's an accident with a public system,
yeah, this was
never an end to it, and you say, you see, these systems don't, it's not good, it doesn't work, and you should give it to a private company
yeah.
that's more, and they immediately elevate it into an ism thing, you know, and so
yeah.
forth. But it's not true when it happens to them, when you got the BP blowing up oil floats and destroying half of New Orleans and all that, they just say, oh, that was an accident.
Yeah,
they don't raise the question of, is this the way capitalism operates? Well, this
right.
is terrible. This is life-threatening. This is destroying our environment and our city and our people. They don't say that. They just say, oh, well, there's been an accident. We got to clean it up. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and then the cleanup goes to social also, and they have to pay for it.
Mm-hmm. Like the public has to pay the costs every time, right? I mean, in the Ontario case, it was a town called Walkerton.
Yes.
And basically this place, they had privatized the water system. And because
it was
of the...
a private one, you said? Did you say Siegfried? I didn't hear you.
Yeah, they privatized the water system there.
Oh.
And basically what ended up happening is it got contaminated by E. coli lack of oversight and this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
About like 8 people ended up dead, like hundreds more got sick, and most of the people who died were kids, right?
Oh my God.
So like this kind of thing like happened. There was a big scandal back in like 1995. Like this happened, right?
Did they put it under public ownership again, or it's still privately owned?
Well, I mean, these days it's like kind of more of like a public-private kind of partnership or whatever it is they call it. I mean, basically it's like maybe some increased oversight, but it's mostly like in the private domain still.
Yeah.
And there's like a lot of privatization going on now. I know the hydro system's about to get privatized and sold off right up here. It's a big, big thing. I mean, some people are being mobilized around it right now. Because that was the next thing I was actually going to ask you about. Like, how are people fighting back against these kind of policies, which are very, very anti-worker, anti-public in general?
Well, they get angry about certain things. You know, PG&E, the company I was telling you about, they were given $42 million, again, socialism supporting capitalism, gave them money to rebuild all various pipelines that had problems, were brittle, leaking, or chipping, or showing signs of being ready to blow up or something.
Mm-hmm.
They did all that, but it didn't really... You know, it wasn't used. It wasn't used for those purposes. PG&E took that money and waged a campaign, a statewide referendum, to prohibit any kind of public utilities in the state of California. They spent millions. They spent millions of dollars on this campaign, and miracle of miracles, they lost anyway. The people did not want to hand over all the utilities to the private profiteers and. Well, I deal with these things in my book. Some of those things, and I also talk about in my book Private Pathology and Other Indecencies. I also talk about how small little things, or you talk about austerity. How about Holocaust? How about extermination? 12 to 18 million Native indigenous peoples in North America. And 500 language groups were all destroyed from what, 1600 to 1890, almost 3 centuries.
Mm.
Just destruction to take an immense fortune from them, an immense fortune of mineral deposits, of waters, of forests, lands, topsoil. I mean, a huge enriched continent taken over, stolen, and killing the people. exterminating the people who are on the land, you know. And that's another thing. And then the immense capital accumulation from slavery, which people don't usually talk about, but you know, cotton was probably the greatest value production of any. I mean, more than coal, more than iron, more than just about anything else for quite a while. It was, and again, that was on the labor of African slaves, people who were brought in here and enslaved in terrible ways. This is the so-called primitive accumulation, mm-hmm. indeed primitive, I would say, murderously primitive. And so I guess the story I'm saying is, the system is an amazing system of horrors and abuses and murder and destruction and mm-hmm. holocausts, and it's all sort of normal. The crises of capitalism, just about every few years, there's a crisis, there's a panic, there's a drop, there's recessions, and it's still going on to this very day. There's still a recession going on right now.
Mm-hmm. And so would you say, like, people are increasingly waking up to the reality of the system here?
I don't know. There certainly are many who are just as stupid and blind to it and bought into it as ever. They watch Fox News and they get roped in. But there are people who are seeing. Look at the protests of the Occupy movement. That was very unusual for the U.S. anyway. Probably better in Canada. I think ideologically somewhat more developed in Canada than they are in the United States. Although there could be plenty of work done there too, and even in Europe, I mm-hmm. think the Europeans were so far ahead and sophisticated. The more I spoke in Europe and went, I realized, my gosh, they got some of the wool has been pulled over their eyes too in some instances, you know. It's just got a lot. There's just an awful that you know where the wake up was with the Occupy movement. It was just that one little phrase, 1% versus 99%.
Right.
So suddenly the great divide that you and I and others have been trying to get across and say, look, there's a great divide here, financially, ideologically, anyway. And of course, and then developing it a little more, and you say, wait, it's not 1%. 1% of the American population is 3 million people. No, they're not super rich. You can be up there in the top 3 million with $200,000 a year, and you're up in that bracket almost. This is like a fraction of 1%. You know, it's a hundredth of 1%. That the super rich have never been more unequal among themselves than they are today. And in other words, in America, in any case, we still don't even realize, we don't know how rich the super rich really are. We look at these homes up on the hill here in Berkeley, and then they go for $2 million, and they're very nice homes indeed. I would never be able to afford such a place. But that's not rich, you know. That could be a professor with tenure and some smart investments could probably float a house like that or something. The very rich are people who live in places where you don't see their front yards that easily, because there's a gate and there's a great estate and there's a special pad for a helicopter or a private plane, and they live really very different.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, there certainly has been people waking up, though. I mean, like, I've been quite impressed by the campaigns for raising the minimum wage, which are, like, in a lot of U.S. cities now, and a lot of, like, low-wage workers, like, from McDonald's even, like, who, you know, most people wouldn't even see them going out on strike, but they're going out on strike. And there's, like, been quite a few actions. Like, it seems like a lot of places, and even in Ontario now, like, we're starting to see, you know, raise the minimum wage to $15. Like, that's becoming a pretty big thing now.
Yes. And And as I say, it gets back to that madness and that contradiction of not paying the people who you need as customers. You know?
It's true. You know, and well, I mean, another thing, of course, like indigenous peoples, I mean, we talked about that before, all the things that they've suffered at the hands of, like, you know, they say primitive accumulation. Mm-hmm. And they're increasingly politically active. You know, like they, I was in, you might have even seen the picture from this when I was in Washington, D.C., like just a few months ago, right? And like, you know, they raised the Mohawk flag outside the White House. And these were people who were coming down in support of Ecuadorian activists who were campaigning against Chevron, you know, what it's done to the Ecuadorian rainforest.
Yeah.
You know, and the devastation that it's caused down there, right? So, I mean, you see these, I mean, that was some very real international solidarity there. And you also had like the indigenous dynamic in there as well. And it was very amazing to be a part of that.
And I get, and sometimes it does reach a point where the oppression can be so extreme that the people who are oppressed have no choice but to fight back. And I mean, when you think of it, who the hell can live on $7 an hour? I mean,
it's true.
At least in this country, the way prices are, the prices are still going up. You know, Gas went down, big deal. Well, that's something, but it's really a shame. It's a shame. It's an insult. It's an offense to people's humanity. It is. So that's what the book is about. I wrote a lot of stuff in there, and it's only 150 pages. But I sort of had fun packing it in. I shouldn't say have fun. Sometimes it was with a painful grimace, but that's the way it goes.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, this is some pretty serious serious stuff we're talking about here, right?
Yes, indeed.
This book, once again, like, sounds very interesting. I know I'm going to try to read it as soon as I can. And this is Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies, which I think you... Who publishes that?
It was... it's Rutledge and Paradigm Publishers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. And once again, like, your website is michaelparenti.org.
That's correct.
And so if people want to, like, read more of your articles or find out about more of your your books, you know, just they can go and check that out. Well,
yes, thank you.
Mm-hmm. And I guess probably what we should end on is Antonio Gramsci's quote. You know, just if all we've talked about, you know, we must have a pessimism of the mind, but an optimism of the will.
Right.
Right. I know you've said that many times, and I know I've certainly tried to take that one to heart. You know, given what we're up against, but what these struggles that we have to basically face, what we have to go through. Very important. All right. So, Michael Parenti, thank you very much for joining us today on Back in the USSR. I really appreciate this.
Thank you, Siegfried. Thank you.
Okay. I'll talk to you soon. All right?
Right. Sure.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.